Hi, this is Alexis Stern here with Diana Abu-Jaber, author of The Language of Baklava, and a number of other fantastic award-winning novels. It's such a pleasure to have her here. And so, Diana, welcome.
Thank you, Alexis. I'm glad to be here.
So, I wanted to actually ask you a number of questions, some dealing with your novel specifically, but others kind of thinking about your different roles as author and as teacher, because you are a full professor at Portland State University, in addition to being such a prolific writer. Some of the questions that I'm going to ask are going to kind of maybe relate to some of those different things. The first question actually that I have for you is what brings you to Ohio State and to the Columbus area today?
Well, I'm very excited to be part of this one book, one community reads program, in which, as I understand it, all the first-year students are reading one or a couple books, actually, in common, and we're all getting together to discuss it. So I was thrilled to hear that one of the books was The Language of Baklava.
Excellent. And so you will then be talking to our students here on campus, and will you be giving a lecture later?
I think probably what I'm going to do is kind of a combined thing. I'm going to do a bit of an informal introduction to the Baklava book and a reading from the Baklava book. And then we'll do a kind of open discussion, Q&A sort of thing. So it should be an interesting event, I think, if I can say that.
Absolutely. What passage, have you selected a passage yet? And what is it and why?
I probably will read from the section where I'm having a lot of trouble with my father and my aunt comes to visit. And I thought long and hard, actually, about what to read for the students today, because it's always hard, for one thing, to excerpt something from a longer work. You know, it's got to kind of hold together and it has to take up a certain amount of time. And you want it to be fairly continuous. And I tried to think about a section that kind of hopefully will connect with the some of the struggles and the issues that the students, especially first-year students, are facing. It's a transitional time for people. This is kind of a transitional time for the whole country right now, actually, because here it is the day after election. So the section in which my aunt comes to visit with us is a real turning point in my life as a young person. And I think of it as a very hopeful section, because she helps really turn around the situation in our house when she comes. She stages a kind of intervention, and she does it through food. So I thought this would be a good tie-in for the program.
Excellent. I actually was able to sit down with a group of about 30 biology majors, freshman biology majors, a couple weeks ago, who had all read your book. And
what'd they think?
They really enjoyed it. It was universal across the board. And it was very interesting, because that's the selection that you chose, because one of the things that the students seem to identify most with were those moments in your book where you I just identify very common experiences that kids have growing up. And they really seemed to identify with that moment. They identified with the moment where you decided you were running away. All different types of moments that really spoke to them across cultures, across boundaries, across genders.
That's awesome. I should probably ask you what I should read, because that you've done a market survey for me.
Yes, I have. And one of the other things that the students seemed to be quite interested in was your use of food, which you just brought up when you're talking about your aunt coming and staging this intervention kind of through food. And they were, one of the things we discussed was why you chose food, why you chose to write this memoir through food. So any kind of insight you can give us on that?
I think that the food, the element of food in the language of baklava was really critical to me for a number of reasons. It grew out of my research for an earlier novel, actually. I had just finished writing a novel called Crescent, and Crescent is set in a Middle Eastern restaurant, and the main character is an Arab-American chef, and in that book, she is from an Iraqi culture, so it's all about the food of Iraq and Iran and other parts of the Middle East, but particularly Iraq, and so I did a lot of research for that book. Tons and tons of work looking up recipes and testing recipes because I really wanted to get it right. And I was doing a lot of food writing myself at the time. So I was doing work as a restaurant critic for the Oregonian newspaper and writing about the history of food and just a lot of thinking about the world of food. And it was something that I had grown up with in an incredibly food-obsessed family. So my editor called me after Crescent was set to be published, and she said, "You've done all this work. You've got all this research. Why don't you go ahead and tell the story of your family, you know, and talk about what it was like growing up in this multicultural yet, you know, food-obsessed family?" And at the time, I thought, maybe I've got an essay at most that I could write. And it turned out that actually I had a lot to say, maybe too much, about food and the intersections of cooking, eating, and culture. For me, it was a very helpful paradigm, a really useful way of organizing my thoughts and my memories about community and family and identity, which are my own obsessions.
Well, and that's exactly what the students seem to pick up on. We also, in talking about the ways in which you used food, the students started volunteering ways in which food had kind of influenced their lives. And we started getting a lot of personal stories based on, you know, someone's little brother used to eat baby food and hot sauce. And so she always, when she thinks about a particular stage in her life growing up, she thinks about baby food and hot sauce. So things like that. So it really does seem like you kind of struck a nerve there in ways that not just Arab American culture, but kind of all cultures really revolve in a lot of ways around food, because I think as your book is evidence of, food comes at a time when families come together, yeah, often. Yeah. So those intersections are very easy to see right there where food and family come together.
Absolutely.
You're
doing great.
We'll edit that out. Hi, Doug. So my next question actually also has something to do with you just referencing your work as a food critic. I noticed in looking at your CV, you do a number of, you write in a variety of genres, although you are visiting us here in a capacity as novelist. You do all kinds of, you do nonfiction writing, you do short stories, you do, you know, all different types of writing. You do academic writing. So how do you master all of those different styles of writing? It's such a, there are so many different generic conventions that you really need to be fluent in to go between those different those genres. And so how did you start branching out? How do you think about your different roles as you're doing these different pieces?
Yeah. I guess the short answer to the question of how you master them is that, at least in my case, you don't. You just, you struggle, because I had only written novels up to the point of The Language of Baklava. I hadn't tried to write a memoir before, and I really wasn't sure how to go about it. I really did approach it like an essay. I thought, I'll just write the one essay. And I found that it did grow out of that kind of a shape, the essay shape. And luckily, as you say, I was also doing journalism at the time and writing a lot of journalistic short pieces. And we had a section for a short while in the Oregonian. It was called, I believe it was called The Art of Eating. And I was writing a number of pieces for that. And each of those pieces was about different kinds of thoughts about eating rituals and preparation and sharing rituals. So that helped me kind of pave the way. But, you know, I have to say I found it very difficult to switch to the memoir format. I was really surprised. And I ended up kind of writing it almost in the same way, organizing it in the same way that I would organize a novel, in which I thought of the different pieces as chapters, and I felt that I wanted to isolate a kind of central theme and a rising action. And in The Language of Baklava, I decided that I was going to really focus on my dad's desire to own a restaurant. And that became one of the guiding principles for me, was talking about that recurring struggle, which it did as I was growing up. It was always kind of the fight of his professional life in America. So that was very, very helpful to me. But I still feel I still feel at sea in a lot of different genres. I'm trying to write a young adult book now, and oh, it's so hard. I thought it was going to be so easy, and it's really difficult. And the same thing was true with writing a mystery. When I wrote Origin, I had to start all over again. Every single time I go to it thinking this is going to be easy, and dang, it's hard.
Do you have any kind of a mentor that you talk to, or people that you seek out when you're trying to work through these very difficult transitions?
I was very lucky when I started. I had a wonderful mentor. My advisor in graduate school was a novelist called Larry Wywoody, and he wrote a beautiful book called Beyond the Bedroom Wall. He was very famous in his time, and I hope everybody who hears this will go and get that book, because I think it's amazing. And then as I've sort of moved into my professional life, I always try to have a writing group. And so either it will be an informal kind of thing where we just send work to each other through email or through the mail. More recently in Portland and in Miami, we've had actual groups that get together every month and we share work. And that is, it's so important to me. I love being able to not only show my work and get feedback, but also talk to people about the writing life. I feel like that is so important.
That's really fantastic. I think one of the things that on campus here that we talk to our students about is sharing their work with others, creating writing groups. I know our writing center offers dissertation writing groups for people who are doing academic writing and need to show it to others. Is this principle something that you bring into your teaching?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Right now I'm teaching some classes online, which is very interesting. Yeah, it's become actually, it's moved from experiment to a regular kind of feature in my teaching now. I found that students really respond to the online community. So I've learned that community can really be created in all kinds of situations. And I will always encourage my students, whether they're a traditional classroom group or online, to try to have some kind of additional meeting outside the classroom, or find a way to continue beyond the end of the term. I think it's especially shocking when students graduate and they get to the end of that program, whether it's undergraduate or graduate, and the world feels very big and cold all of a sudden, and you miss the nurturing, and you miss the feedback that you get in the formal setting. And a writing group is a really, really important way of getting that to go on.
Back to the language of baklava, if we may. I have a few specific questions. I'm such a fan of the book. And in writing a memoir, you obviously have to put a lot of yourself in there, but you also have to put a lot of others in there. So I'm just wondering what your family's reaction was, what your friends' reaction were. Were people excited? Were they anxious? Or did you get any phone calls in the middle of the night?
Yes, I did get some phone calls, as a matter of fact. It's tricky because I do find that being a writer, you borrow all the time from the people in the world around you. You just, you know, you're an observer and a recorder. And so even to a certain extent, writing novels, this is true. You take from the world. And so when I was writing the memoir, I was very conscious of trying not to ask permission. I didn't want to invite too many people to weigh in because I am extremely permeable and very much given to, you know, trying to make everyone happy. You know, I want to be loved 24/7, you know, and so the idea that someone might not approve of something I'd written or have a different way of seeing it, I realized that was pretty likely, and I wanted to avoid too much self-censorship. So I talked to a lot of people about it. I actually talked to a psychologist about it. Yeah, and she told me that everyone has the right to own their own story. And, you know, I found that very useful, actually. I found that incredibly helpful. She was making a really important point about the sanctity of our own voices. And it's funny that it had to come from a member of the helping profession, but sometimes that's what it takes. And so I didn't ask too many people to look at the work ahead of time. I did have a conversation with my mother about it, and she was the one who kind of said, you know what, go for it. Don't worry about the family. Just write it the way you need to. And I took her at her word. Now, after it came out, all kinds of reactions. I mean, probably the biggest struggle was with my father. He called me up one day and he said that he was very upset with me, that he said that he didn't like that I had portrayed him as yelling. And he said, you know, I can't believe you feel this way. I don't understand it. I am the nicest, most peaceful guy in the world. And I don't yell. I never yell. I don't yell. And he starts yelling. And so my husband and I were there at the time. And he's marching back and forth in the condo. They live in this condo in Pompano Beach. Marching back and forth. I never yell. I don't know where you got this from. And so I said, well, Dad, listen, you do yell. You yell all the time. You're a big old yeller. You're old yeller. And my mom jumped in. She said, it's true. You yell. You yell all the time. You're constantly yelling. You yell your head off. And Dad thought about it. And he said, I do? I yell? And then he kind of took it in and he kind of processed it. And he said, all right. Well, maybe I do yell, but even if I do yell, you didn't have to write a book and tell everybody in the world about it. And, you know, and it's true. And I said, you're right, Dad. You're right. I didn't have to tell everybody, but I did. And so when people ask me about that, I say, you know, the moral is be very careful what you write but be very careful how you raise your kids because they might grow up and write a book about you. And so, and that's my word on the subject.
That's fantastic. Now, was there a particular section of the language of baklava that you remember being very excited about writing? Was there anything that really stuck out in your mind as you were writing it? It's just like, this is going to be really great stuff.
You know, mostly what I remember is fear, like big fear when I would tell certain stories and thinking, oh, I don't know if I can tell this story. I don't know. And a number of the stories, I actually had to make a deal with myself that I was going to write them, but I wouldn't use them, you know, because it was the only way I could tell the story. So actually, one of the first stories, the story of the slaughtered lamb, was kind of a hard one for me to write, actually. And so I wrote it telling myself I'm not going to use it. Also, the story in which my aunt and uncle reveal that they've kept a woman prisoner in their house as their personal slave. That one was another one that I thought, I'm going to get in too much trouble. I can't tell this story. And then I wrote them, and then once they were in the world and they existed, I felt like it would be kind of fraudulent not to include them, because part of what I wanted to do with the language of baklava was to try to tell my own truth, you know, my own experience with the world. And so as scary as those moments were, I went with it and I decided I had to include them.
Well, speaking of scary, your latest novel, Origin, is a thriller. This is a departure for you, and you alluded a few minutes ago to that being, you know, a departure and being a struggle, kind of jumping into this new type of writing. What made you decide to move in this direction?
You know, I think I'm very perverse. I really do. I think that I seem to have a need to reinvent the wheel with every book. So there's that. And I think that I have this absolute dread of writing the same story over and over again. You know, and then you find out that you end up doing that anyway. You know, that all writers seem to have their personal obsessions, and we're haunted by different kinds of themes. So even though I thought that writing a mystery would make it a very different story, I find that I still wrote about themes of identity and belonging and family, just in different clothing. And the mystery genre itself came to me partly from living in Florida. Florida is mystery central. And I was going out to readings and talks, and they were all these mystery writers, and they looked like they were having so much fun. And I just thought, well, how hard can this be? Oh, they all write according to a script, right? And so I decided I was just going to write this formula book, and it would be so easy, and I'd knock it off. And nothing could have been further from the truth. It was so challenging. It took me years to write Origin. Yeah.
Well, that's something that is actually potentially helpful for our aspiring writers to hear, the writing process, that it can be a quite lengthy process and a kind of slow-moving process. Any kind of advice for people?
Those guys are laughing in the background. How dare they? We should tell them. Advice for writers, for me, it tends to focus on figuring out your process and understanding they're bugging us. Now Alexis is going to yell at the guys in the lobby. And, she's giving them the evil eye. And, here she comes. I think she gave them the evil eye. All right. They're all gone. Okay. Good work. Okay, so we're talking about
advice for writers.
I think that... It will be a very free form kind
sure
of thing.
Will.
Yeah.
Sure Doug's gonna love this in the editing room.
I figured out. Everyone has their own approach to writing, and figuring out what works to help you write, I think, is very important. Some people are able to sit down and write for hours without stopping, and I've never been that writer. I need to move around and sort of play and take breaks, and I tend to be a very opportunistic writer. I try to write whenever there's a free moment. So that might mean stopping at a stoplight. It might mean writing while I'm cooking. I often write in the middle of the night when I can't sleep. And I'll encourage students to be aware of the times and the places that work for them. I do think that by trying to follow somebody else's rules, sometimes we work against ourselves and we make it even harder. It's already hard. We make it even harder than it has to be a writer. So figure out, do you have a chair that you like to sit in? Do you write better in the morning or in the evening? Do you need to take a lot of breaks? That's okay. And just give yourself permission to find your own way and not beat yourself up if it's not going exactly according to plan.
Great. Thank you for that advice. we have a lot of students on campus who are kind of struggling writers, and our MFA program is, it's hard writing this stuff, and it's really great to see, someone who does it successfully, and to get that advice, I think is going to be very valuable to them. Speaking of cozy places, is it your favorite chair, etc.? Do you have a cozy place? Do you have a favorite place to write, or a place that makes you feel very peaceful?
I find I love to write by the water. That is incredibly inspiring to me. And that was one of the great revelations of moving to Florida. When we lived in Portland, we often would go to the Oregon coast, and I had a friend who had a beach house that overlooked the water, and I found that I could do a lot of writing there. I always thought it was the house, but then I discovered when we got to Florida and I started going out to the beach that it had the same effect for me. Of course, we don't live at the beach. So what I will often do is I'll sit outside And just being in nature and listening to the sounds of the trees, the wind, smelling things, really brings me into my senses. I'm very interested in sensual writing anyway. And so having that, for me, what feels like a very heightened state of sensory awareness is very, very inspiring and really conducive to the writing process. You know, that, of course, and lying in bed and and writing in bed, you know, I do that a lot. And I think that's writing out of a dream state, which is also incredibly helpful.
What are you reading right now? Best thing you're reading at this moment.
Okay. I'm reading a short story collection. I hope I get the title right. I think it's called In the Land of Women. It's by a Florida writer, Lynn Barrett, and it's published by a small press. I think it's University of Chicago Press, and they're wonderful short pieces. I just met Lynn at a reading and have started in our book, and I'm enjoying it immensely.
So everyone, go out, buy this book, read it, memorize it, send fan mail, etc. Additionally, send fan mail to Diana Abu Jabber, famous author, teacher, full professor, all around great gal. I think that that's actually probably about all the time that we have for this session. I want to thank you so much for letting me interview you and for giving us all this great insight. And thanks for coming and supporting our Common Book Program for our freshmen, too.
Absolutely. It's an honor to be here, and I'm loving it already.